Welcome to episode 242 of the 6G podcast. It's the latest inside scoop on everything 6G, and we cover six topics in about 30 minutes, and it's brought to you by More Insights and Strategy. I'm Anshul Sog, and joining me this week is fellow analyst Mike Dano from Ookla, who will co-host the podcast with me from here on out.
Yeah, no, Anshul, thanks so much for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity. I know I have big shoes to fill with Will heading out into the sunset and wishing him the best of luck. And I'm going to do my best to work inside of the long shadow that he cast. And I'm happy to have this opportunity to talk to you. I listened to the podcast. I'm a longtime listener, first time caller in this regard. And so I've listened to the podcast that you guys have done for a long time. And it's really useful and a lot of good stuff in there. And I'm excited to keep it going. And I think the rebrand is what we were just talking ahead of the recording of this. And I think the rebrand to the 6G podcast is exactly right. It's the right time to do that. I think that was a good call on your part. And now we're really hitting, I think, the 5G lull. And I think now is a good time to start talking about all things 5G, but also getting ready for whatever's next.
Yeah. And honestly, this is a great segue because I feel like I've been wanting to do the transition to 6G even before Will left. This was, I think, just a lot of great timing. We've got MWC coming up. We'll talk about that in another episode leading up to the show. I didn't mention this, but I will be going to Samsung Galaxy Unpacked, which is next week. That'll be a bunch of new 5G phones, but I'm sure there'll be some 6G references, and we'll talk about that next week. But I wanted to throw to you in your first topic, which is related to 5G Americas.
That's right. And yeah, it's an unfortunate situation, but certainly a sign of the times and a sign of where we are right now. We talked about 5G kind of hitting a lull, and this is really representative of that. So if you're not familiar with it, there's a trade association called the 5G Americas, and they have been around for a long time. I still have pens and some notepads that say 3G Americas, and I think there's a lot of us out there who have saved some of that swag over the years. But they've been a great trade association over the years. They usually have an annual event for analysts, and they put out a lot of white papers, do a lot of work on the spectrum front in terms of trying to set aside spectrum for 3G or 4G. And they've been around for a long time. Chris Pearson over there and the new guy who showed up a couple of years ago. But the news is that, so they were 3G Americas, then they turned into 4G Americas during the 4G phase. And then, of course, they turned into 5G Americas. But the news that hit this week was that they're shutting down operations. So they will no longer be around. The Beat over there wrote a real nice thing about there. It's a bittersweet moment for him. And it is unfortunate. I'm sure that we wish everybody over at 5G America is just the very best. It was a great association. They did a lot of really good stuff, put out a lot of really useful information. But I think it's definitely a sign of the times in that 5G sales are slowing down. A lot of the RAN sales are flat to negative. And the interest in 5G has really cooled off. It's just the cycle is ending and that era has passed, really. And so the closing of the 5G Americas trade group is really representative of, I think, the fact that I wouldn't say we're closing the book on 5G, but we're really entering a new era where I think everybody's starting to look forward to what's next.
Yeah, I think I agree in a lot of ways. I enjoyed a lot of their events. I think I joined during the 4G America days, but I do think it was really interesting to see things start to peter off with time. Every year that they had a little less people and less vendors, it was never a bad event because there were always really interesting people and discussions to be had. And I feel like I always learned something from attending. I think honestly, they would have been better sales not trying to do it in October when now everybody does everything in October and it's like impossible to squeeze it in. And that was honestly the main reason why I didn't attend for the last year or two. But yeah, I think it's sunsetting 5G in there because it's a fit for the phase where we are today with 5G and just the fact that it's not really a focal point for anybody. Even if there is a spectrum discussion, it's a 6G spectrum discussion, not a 5G one. I feel like everyone's focus has shifted, which is part of the reason why I think this podcast has changed. Even if Will didn't leave, we were going to make the transition to 6G because MWC is going to be all 6G. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. I totally forgot about that, even though I talked about it a couple of days ago. I think that will allow me to switch to my topic, which is that Samsung and KT, which is Korea Telecom, were able to hit record 6G speeds. in the seven gigahertz band. Obviously, there isn't a 6G network today. So this is really about using 7 gigahertz potentially for 6G using Keysight's 6G test equipment. This is very much a test trial kind of thing. They're using the XMIMO configuration, and I think they hit something like 3 gigabits per second. Yeah, they achieved a downlink of 3 gigabits per second. What's interesting is none of the coverage of this I could find out would tell me how much bandwidth they were using to achieve that 3 gigabits per second. It could be like 100 megahertz or 200. I'm unclear. I would assume at most it would probably be 100, just considering how spectrum is chopped up today, but it's unclear. Also, I feel like represents the state of where we are in 6G today, which is a lot of 6G is test and experimental and like making sure the idea works, but not really like remotely commercially ready. And I feel like we're getting mixed signals on when commercialization will hit, because I hear 2030, I hear 2029, I hear pre-commercial 2028. I think we're going to have a lot of these discussions this year and next, especially as more trials and things happen. I'd love to hear what you think about it.
For sure. No, I totally agree. And I think that I am not surprised that they're talking about 7 gigahertz. That really seems like ground zero for 6G. And we were talking about the 5G America Trade Association. They really did do a good job in ushering in the era of 5G, particularly by helping to release mid-band spectrum. In the US, the 2.5 gigahertz for T-Mobile, and then of course the C-band for AT&T and Verizon, and then 3.45 a little bit later. But anyway, all that mid-band spectrum was really ground zero for 5G. And as 6G comes, a big focus that I have been watching over the past few years is to see where is 6G going to land? Because I think that certainly 6G is going to be more spectrally efficient, right? It's going to have new technologies. It's going to do this, that, and the other. My hope is that it has, I can't remember what the name of that technology is, but it's Sidelink. It's where the phones can talk directly to each other. They do not need to go to a cell tower in order to have a communication. So you can have a walkie-talkie, basically. I think that would be super helpful at places like ski areas or on a road trip where you're going in and out of coverage. I think that'd be awesome. But that's one of the technologies that is going to be most likely included in the next set of standards. You can only get so efficient. And like my understanding of 5G was that it was about like 10, 20, 30% more efficient than 4G, but it was really the addition of additional spectrum. That was the big deal. And so I think the same is true with 6G, right? The 6G standard is probably going to be a little bit more efficient. It's going to have more bells and whistles, new things that you can do. But I think part of the objective of launch, of rolling out another generation of technology, is including more spectrum. And so the fact that they have been talking about 6G, I know the Trump administration signed an executive order naming 7 gigahertz as one of the specific bands that they're going to look at for 6G. So I think that's interesting to hear from the perspective of KT, that they're also looking at 6G in that particular spectrum band.
You also made me think about Sidelink. This would be the third attempt to get Sidelink to happen, because we had it in release 12 and in release 15. And that means that this might be the time for Sidelink to actually be a thing.
I mean, if a carrier offered it, that's a competitive advantage. I feel like that's something that somebody ought to do. Get on that. Whoever's listening out there, get on that.
It's just funny because there's a lot of opportunities there, especially when you consider other types of devices other than smartphones. Because it's like not that different from like V2V or V2X. But what I also was thinking about was China tried to block off 6 gigahertz for 6G, not allowing it to be used for Wi-Fi. But now it's like everyone wants to use 7 gigahertz. So they might have not even picked the right frequency. But the one thing that I'm always concerned about with 7 gigahertz is propagation. Because, you know, I have Wi-Fi 6, which runs in the 6 gigahertz band, and Wi-Fi 6E or Wi-Fi 7 is 6 gigahertz. But it doesn't propagate very well. You need a lot of power. And it's going to be interesting to see, because I've had these discussions with Qualcomm already about what they're doing to mitigate some of those 7 gigahertz challenges with coverage. But the one thing I was thinking about also is, based on the conversations I've been having with carriers, it sounds like 6G is going to be fairly limited in its deployment initially. So it might not even be an issue to have limited coverage because they're going to have limited deployments to begin with, but they will have maybe more, a little bit more time to figure out how to deploy 6G and at 7 gigahertz, assuming they're not refarming spectrum right off the bat.
Right. I think we can all breathe a sigh of relief in that few people are talking about the terahertz bands anymore for 6G. I think that is a good sign that we're not really having any serious discussions about that. Because in the early days of 6G, a couple of years ago, when people started kicking around the idea, there was some discussion about those terahertz bands, which are super high. Propagation is just awful. And I'm sure that somebody can get it work, but get a commercial network up and running. But to what purpose when your transmissions only stretch a couple hundred feet?
Yeah. And your bandwidth is affected by humidity.
Yeah, exactly. I can't see that working very well. That's at least 7 gigahertz is presumably the propagation would be a little bit better in 7 gigahertz than the terahertz bands.
Definitely. I think next topic should be yours.
Yes. Moving along. We got a couple good topics to cover. That's right. And now I have a little bit of shameless self-promotion to go over. As you may know, I work at Ookla. For the past 25 years, I've been a journalist, worked at places like Light Reading, Fierce Wireless, covering the industry. And last year, I decided to take the exciting step into the analyst game and took a job with Ookla. And if you're familiar with Ookla, Ookla is the company behind the Speedtest app. And they also have a couple of other lines of business. They've got RootMetrics, which does drive testing, which is Wi-Fi installation and Wi-Fi monitoring. And then also DownDetector, that's a global outage tracking service. And so it's been a very interesting year in terms of learning all of the data, swimming through the Ookla data lake. There's all kinds of sources of data, all sorts of interesting things to look at. And along with that, my colleague, Luke, who is probably one of the smartest guys I think I've ever met, but he just put out a report about, he's citing Ookla Speedtest data, and the report was about 5G SA standalone. And it's pretty interesting. There's a lot to go through in the report. It's about all the operators that are launching standalone 5G, what kind of speeds they're seeing, what the implementations look like, stuff about the core network. This report just goes on and on. But the thing that I think is pretty interesting and something that I didn't really know about. Like, I had heard rumors about this, but it's what's nice about this report is that it really kind of looks at this specifically, which is how 5G standalone affects battery life. And apparently it affects it pretty well. The Luke's findings was specific. So I'm going to read this from the report. Specifically, EE in the UK, they have a standalone network, and the data shows that the device that's on 5G SA, its battery lasts 22% longer than if it were on non-standalone NSA. And same with O2 in the UK, 11% better battery life on 5G SA compared to the 5G NSA, the first version of 5G, 5G non-standalone NSA. So I just think that's pretty interesting, right? And again, I feel like here's yet another missed opportunity for operators out there is, dude, launch Sidelink. Hey, we've got walkie-talkie phones for you. Dude, talk about 5G standalone. Your battery life is literally better. These are the things that normal people really do care about, better battery life. Like, that is something that would get me to change carriers, depending on the phone that I had. But it would certainly be a selling point, right?
Yeah, what's funny is I have never been able to discuss that as a selling point for standalone when telling people about different carriers' experiences. But it's a no-brainer because you're only connected to one network at a time. You don't have to connect to 4G and 5G. Who does think it would save you power? Also, you're going to also benefit from lower latency and higher speeds. So those are all better things. And I do think some of the benefits with SA are also coming from higher speeds, which then allow you to get off the network faster, right? You down your data and you turn off the modem. Like, I'm following 5G modems and 4G modems for a very long time. And the thing they do better is they just download things faster so they're on for less time. That's literally the power saving for most of what they do. Not a shock to me that if you have a more efficient network, you also have a more efficient device.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always great to have data to support that thesis. And yeah, to your point, it should push carriers to move faster, especially when you consider that there's added benefits to having an NSA network, like being able to support stuff like RedCap, which is also a great power saving opportunity in 5G, which still gives you low latency. And hey, guess what? All the new Apple Watches all have 5G RedCap. So if you want to be able to use a new Apple Watch to the best of its ability with the best battery life, you want to have a carrier that supports tandem. Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's always fun to have supportive data for a theory.
Yeah, interesting stuff. But yeah, you've got, and now I'm going to toss it back to you, because on our list of stuff that we're going to talk about, you have, I think you actually win the award for the most exciting story topic or topic to talk about. Kinetic tokens. I don't even know what that is. This is the one that I was like, I'm going to listen very closely to see what you have to say about this.
Yes. So this was a terminology, I believe I looked this up, has been coined by T-Mobile's John Saw, who is formerly of Sprint and formerly of Clearwire. So he has been in the industry for a very long time and has been a very forward thinker in a lot of ways. So T-Mobile is very lucky to have acquired him with Sprint. And I worked with him when he was at Sprint as well. And he talked about kinetic tokens and the idea of physical AI and 6G, and the idea that when you're doing AI on a device that's in motion, you're going to want to have on-device AI, but you're also going to want to be able to service that device with AI from the edge and from the cloud. And it's like a continuum of compute that occurs from device all the way up to the cloud. And you're going to have different types of models, and you're going to have different types of tokens. And the important part here to understand is that they're going to need to be very low latency tokens, as opposed to currently, which is a lot of the KPIs for AI tokens is mostly the tokens per second, right? Because you're getting this huge document spit out or inch of words or images, and it's all tokens per second. But the truth is, with something like physical AI, you need the tokens to be very quick, because you don't have the luxury of waiting for the tokens to arrive as you're driving down the road, right? That's just not a thing. Or if a drone's flying in the sky. So these really low latency tokens are these kinetic tokens that serve the device appropriately based on the application and the device, and enable better use cases and better experience for the user or the device, depending on how it's being operated. And that these tokens will be generated, whether they're on device or at the edge, for 6G applications. And it also talking about like how they're already on the road to this with what they're doing with live translation in the network, with their 5G advanced networks, where they're doing real-time translation for people, and it's device agnostic. Only one person has to be a T-Mobile customer, and it works with 50 languages. I think real-time translation is a very low-hanging fruit, but it's an interesting application nonetheless. We also talked a little bit about some 6G applications that are already in the standard or are almost certain to be in the standard, like ISAC, which is integrated sensing and communications. And there's just so many opportunities with that alone, paired with something like kinetic tokens, where let's say you have a drone in the sky, the network can actually track the location, position, and speed of that drone and identify it as a drone and also send it packets or tokens as it's flying to make sure that it's getting the right data to perform its mission more effectively. So that way it doesn't need to have too much compute on device, because we're always trying to reduce the weight and cost of these kinds of devices. And one of the few ways to do that is by removing compute as much as possible. And especially when you consider the memory crunch that we're going to be going through for the next year or two, then it could be an opportunity to do too much on-device AI, because we don't have the memory to enable that. Lots of cool ideas. Also some talk of how is 6G and AI going to work? Well, a lot of what they're thinking about is they're going to run the RAM with the 6G RAM with NVIDIA and their hardware, which will have some added capacity for compute, for AI compute on top of that. And they'll be able to coexist in the same space at the same power levels as they were using before.
Yeah, I agree. John Saw is a super smart guy. And so I listen to everything he says very carefully. So if he's talking about this kind of stuff, I am not sure that I am sold on the T-Mobile AI RAN, NVIDIA chips in the base station. This is what 6G is going to be. I know that's what they're pushing toward. And I think it's smart, right? Like, this is the time to talk about it. Everyone's talking about NVIDIA GPUs and what AI can do. I'm still struggling to understand the reason why T-Mobile thinks that this is going to work. I get that you want to have processing closer to the users, but the idea of having a bunch of GPUs inside of every single base station, like, that is an extremely high cost, and it'll still be an extremely high cost 5 years from now. And so how to recoup that cost if you sell AI processing inside the base stations? Are you going to really need to do that? And is there not anywhere else where you could potentially buy that kind of computing capacity? I think there are instances where it would make sense, but this sort of broad canvas that T-Mobile is painting about, all the base stations are going to have NVIDIA in them, and we're going to be in the AI token business. I wouldn't say I'm sold on that just quite yet. I need to see a little bit more.
I think you're right. I had view maybe a year or two ago, and I still am in a lot of ways. But I think what has convinced me about the strategy that will work, I was a very big critic of XR and 5G, because you needed to have compute close to the edge, and there was no model to enable those GPUs to get close enough to the edge to make thin and light 5G glasses possible. But if the compute is there because of AI, then you can double dip on AI compute for AI workloads, but also for streaming graphics workloads, because they're still GPUs. The way I look at it, maybe there's an opportunity to have multiple types of industries take advantage of that compute. And I see the opportunity to help also get that GPU compute for other applications other than AI. But AI is like the justification for it. But to your point, we still have to see these things actually get deployed and used and be commercially viable. I think what has maybe given me more confidence is that Ericsson and Nokia are taking this as well. It's not just NVIDIA trying to push it themselves with T-Mobile. But to your point, we're still a few years out from having commercial deployments, and the performance of these platforms will have to improve as well. And they'll probably have new GPUs that might need to be more power hungry. Who knows? But power was the point of discussion that I had with John, because power is a problem. And he didn't seem concerned, which I hope is a good thing. But yeah, there's a lot of, we've talked about all kinds of Open RAN and AI RAN kind of opportunities. And the truth is, like, they're not as big as they used to be. But I will also say that there have been some improvements, and I feel like we're closer today than we were 5 years ago.
Yeah. And I will say, I even before John saw Neville Ray talked about, he thinks that wearables are going to be big at some point. Wearables and augmented reality glasses, where you move your head and stuff moves around as you're looking around. Like, I do. And even we see the Meta Ray-Ban glasses, which I have not yet played with, but you've got some. I'm not surprised at all, but we're getting down that road. Like, that kind of stuff used to be on PowerPoint and now you're putting it on. You're literally putting those glasses on right now. It's hysterical. I know. I feel my glasses are not nearly as cool.
Not as thick.
Yeah. Not as thick. That's for sure. Yeah.
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 I would also say you make a really good point. I actually think AI wearables might be it. Think about all the AI companies that want to bring some kind of AI wearable to market, whether it's OpenAI, Anthropic, or Apple. I think that might even be one of the opportunities where they embed a 5G or a 6G RedCap modem in the device, so it's completely independent of your smartphone, and it can do all the AI stuff it needs to do with the help of the cloud. So I don't know, but I think that there might be some opportunities with 6G and AI, and the timing seemed to be really good for T-Mobile. John was saying how we're early to 5G, so their hardware refresh for 6G might actually be perfectly timed for when they need to make that change.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, do we have time for this last? I've got one more topic, but it's heavy.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it, because it is related to what we've been talking about. So I've got one more thing on my list to talk about, but it's definitely related to all this, which is just the data center boom that's going on this year. And it's related to what we're talking about, because T-Mobile is talking about putting GPUs inside of its base stations and running AI applications that way. And I can see why T-Mobile is interested in that, because, and here's the newest numbers that are fresh as of about this week. The new number for the amount that the top hyperscalers in the world are going to invest into the creation of additional data centers for AI is $710 billion in 2026 alone. That is how much they're spending in order to build additional data centers in the US and globally just this year, which is, I realize we're at the peak of the bubble of AI. I don't know if it's going to continue or if it's going to pop or what, who knows. But certainly the idea that these companies are investing that much money in the creation of additional data centers is just, it's just mind-boggling. $710 billion is a staggering figure, I think. But here's the thing that I've been trying to look at is, like, what does that mean? Where is all that money going? And what I think is interesting is that it is going into additional data centers, but many of them are the sort of big, giant, sprawling data centers that sit out in the wilds of Montana and are not at all the idea of an edge computing location like at the base of a cell tower. These are gigantic factory-sized warehouses that are just literally full of AMD chips or NVIDIA chips or whatever. And what I think, though, I'm trying to understand the evolution of the data center investment cycle from the perspective of what does it mean for telecom? And there's a couple of interesting things. One thing is they keep struggling to get additional power to all these data centers, require a ton of electricity in order to run. And it's putting big strains on the power grid. And so according to this one report from JLL that came out this week, natural gas is still the dominant approach in order of powering these data centers. They're using a lot of natural gas. And the other big power generation method for these data centers is gas turbines. And I've seen they're literally buying jet engines. Like companies that build jet engines are selling jet engines to data centers in order to power the data center, which just tells you how, like, what an insane world we live in. Like, the future is just crazy. But again, I'm trying to understand, like, how these data centers, what does it mean for telecom? What I thought was two things that I think are interesting. One is that a company called Backblaze, put out a new report this week talking about traffic flows over networks. And the summary of that report is that it's really, the traffic flows are huge. There are large data sets consisting of images and videos and metadata, and that's all being used to train AI models and stuff. But those data sets are traveling over super high bandwidth private connections. They're not going over the regular internet, basically. And so that's why you're seeing companies like Lumen sign all these agreements in order to do AI transport. It's basically data center to data center. Like, those are the transport type things that we're seeing. And that's where, from what I understand, the bulk of AI traffic today is really that. It's huge data sets traveling from one data center to another. And that's the impact to the telecom industry today. But then also companies like Akamai and Backblaze and stuff, there are sort of these neo clouds. And so they're setting up GPU rental sites in order to sell GPU by the hour, basically. So if you are a company that wants to experiment into AI, you can rent a GPU by the hour, and you can do it from companies like Akamai. But again, and it's relevant to T-Mobile, is that, so Akamai announced this, they're doing really well. They're totally sold out of the 20 cities where they built these GPU farms, but Akamai stock fell because basically Wall Street is unsure as to whether or not that is a sustainable business model. And they're worried that the investment into some of that sort of AI bubble stuff is just too much. And so I'm thinking from the perspective of a T-Mobile or a telecom company that wants to put GPUs in the base station, I don't know, like, even Akamai is not being rewarded for the work that it's doing in building these AI-focused neoclouds with full of GPUs and stuff. I think the whole data set, it's obvious there's a ton of investment going on into data centers, but I'm still unconvinced that it will trickle down into the telecom companies that, like, you and I have been talking to. I feel like this is another area where companies like Google and Meta are going to really capture the lion's share of things, at least right now. I don't know. Like, I could be proven wrong. We'll have to see. And I also, here's the last thing I'll say is I think it will matter where this is going to go down. So in the US, there's like already 4,000 data centers all over the country. Like, I feel like that's a lot. Other countries, far fewer. And so in those cases, if you're a much smaller country, with very few data center operations. There, a telecom company could build data centers for AI, and that would make sense in terms of data sovereignty and all that stuff, and keeping data inside of that country within the telecom operator's network. And we're seeing some telecom operators doing that, building their own data centers for sovereign AI applications. That makes sense to me. But for a company like T-Mobile in the US with that already has so many data centers, and I don't know. We'll see. I'm not convinced.
I think you make a good point on the countries that don't have as many data centers as the US. I also think there's some challenges. Every time the carriers have tried to be more than a big dumb pipe, they haven't necessarily been very successful. But I also think if they establish the right partnerships, they could be partnered with the Googles and Amazons and Microsofts of the world to enable those clouds to be more close to the user. So we'll see. But yeah, the spend is absurd. The power demands building nukes as fast as possible. I think one of the few things that I see in terms of the benefits of this potential infrastructure buildup is maybe we end up with a bunch of new nuclear reactors that give us a lot of clean power.
I'd appreciate that. Just cheaper power, like, I'm down.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, even if this doesn't end up being what we hoped, it maybe incentivizes more clean energy. I'm optimistic, but I think a lot of this CapEx is really coming down to FOMO and not being outspent by your competition and not having the capacity when it's needed, because right now a lot of them are pretty capacity constrained, and Google has their own stuff and they build their own chips, but they still have to get power from somebody. And yeah, it's really interesting to see the crazy things people are doing to get power. I know they got in trouble with Tennessee for doing unpermitted power solutions while we're emitting more fuel excess than they were permitted to have. So it is crazy, but as somebody who has to live it every day, it's hard to contextualize $710 billion in CapEx.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just, it's a huge factor above what we're used to, the kind of CapEx that we're used to.
And it also doesn't help that there's all kinds of weird financing models that are being deployed. I saw a few recently that I'm like very confused by. I'm just hoping we're not in a bubble that cannot be slowly deflated.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Okay, so I think I will wrap it up with my third and final topic. And that was an announcement from Microsoft to Ericsson. And they are integrating Ericsson Advanced Enterprise Mobility into Windows 11. They are building in enterprise 5G connectivity with support for stuff like Intune and eSIM provisioning into Windows itself. The way I look at it, this is a way to enhance Microsoft security for Windows, but also to make it easier for IT departments to manage 5G laptops and to do that securely within the environments that they're already working within. So it's really just like about enabling AI, of course, with constant connectivity via 5G, but doing it in an easy to manage and a cost-effective way. I think this is just like a net positive, because Windows needed something like this, like in order to just have more 5G burst kind of thoughts and features. What's interesting is that this is being piloted by the Surface 5G devices. So this is not all Windows devices yet, but they are building it native into Windows 11. They're making Windows 11 natively cellular and enterprise managed. I think it's a great thing. I wish I had a Surface 5G. I think my current Surfaces are not 5G, or I don't have the Surface 5G laptop, which they did release last year. But I'm going to try and go through I think I actually do have one. I have to go back and look through all of my laptops. I have too many of them. It's another problem. But yeah, I think
problems of device analysts, right? Yeah.
Yes. And I do get a lot of crap from my colleagues who don't get as many devices because they would like to have new laptops too. And the truth is, I give away it. Yeah, this was not a very deep topic, but it is an interesting one because I think that does set the stage for 6G.
Yeah, to say, I'm very surprised. When 5G first rolled around, I thought for sure this is the time when laptops would have cellular integrated. And in a couple of years, the only laptop you'd be able to buy was one that had cellular in it. And that hasn't really happened. And I'm honestly surprised that if I had placed bets, I would have bet that would have happened. And it really hasn't. But when you think about it, from the perspective of just a regular everyday person, that would you buy the laptop that's $100 or $200 cheaper? You'd probably buy the one that's $200 cheaper. If you were given the option, you'd buy the one that was $200 cheaper. And so I think just that stumbling block of the cellular version is always going to be more expensive, I think is a real. And then on the other side of things, you have to, if you have a 5G capable one, now you have to figure out how to do the service plan and you can't share the data on your smartphone. You got to get a separate service plan. And so I think there's a lot of reasons why that hasn't taken off. And the last thing I'll say too is, because my laptop doesn't have 5G, I'm glad about it because it has great battery life. And when I need to, when I'm out and about, I can just tether with my phone. And I like that. I think that works really well, especially I've got a new phone, so the battery life is really good. So yeah, I think, will that situation change in 6G? Is 6G going to bring us more integrated laptops? Or are all the MacBooks going to have 6G in them when that rolls around?
What's funny is, a lot of PC OEMs have been holding on to 5G laptops until Apple does. So I think we might actually get that moment when Apple does it with their own PCs, with their Macs.
With their own silicon.
Because they have their own modems now. So the cost of doing that is much lower than if they use a Qualcomm modem, which is, I actually did a recent 5G survey of people who are actively deploying 5G in PCs. And from all of interesting data, which I'll be publishing in a report fairly soon. The survey concluded right when I had my second kid, so I wasn't planning other time to actually get that survey data.
A little busy, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but the truth is, the number one complaint is actually coverage. So inconsistent coverage, not enough coverage. And a lot of companies are working on that right now by offering 5G PC services that have all three carriers at the same time and just switch to the best carrier where you are, which I think is going to solve a lot of those challenges. But to your point, the cost is still an issue. Enterprises are much more willing to spend that money because they can secure their connection. No connecting to coffee Wi-Fi, no hotel Wi-Fi. All those are wildly insecure. And then also just being always be connected. As somebody who goes to a lot of client sites, the amount of times that I have to authenticate my laptop on their network and get all the permissions and then still be filtered to not be able to use AI or whatever things I want to do, it's actually quite nice to have 5G. But there are definitely types of personas, which we also found in who uses 5G the most and why. But yes, this is still a fundamental thing that should have been done a long time, right? And it's just another piece of the equation of making 5G easier to deploy and use regular rate. And yes, the carriers are also a problem in terms of, I think we'll get there, I think, eventually. I think Apple might help quite a bit. I can tell you, once you get a 5G laptop, it's very hard to go back.
All right. So my objective now is not to get a 5G laptop. I'll keep my Wi-Fi for as long as I can.
Yeah, it'll cost you.
Yeah, cheap price. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. We'll see how it develops. And that's everybody out there. That's your job, right? Make the stuff easier.
Definitely. And I wanted to say thank you very much for joining me today. I really, I know we ran a little long this week, and I think we'll tighten it up a little bit for our listeners so they can get it under 30 minutes. Otherwise, we hope our viewers and listeners found this week's topic interesting. And please don't forget to join us next week, and don't forget to rate and subscribe. And once again, I want to say thanks a lot for Mike for joining me. It's been great so far, and I'm excited to see where this goes.
Let's do it. Sounds good.